Okay, let's go ahead and get started. First, thank you everyone for coming this afternoon. I'm Allie Van Doren, one of the librarians here at LSSU Library. That afternoon, we have one of our own professors on campus here as a part of our scholar series, connected with the Campus Read. So if you haven't checked out the Campus Read book yet, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Locks, which I should have grabbed a copy, we do have copies back behind the desk if you want to read up on some of the things that are connected to what Dr. Hutchins is going to be talking about. Coming up, we have some brochures up at the front desk there, at the circulation desk, of some of the different events that we've got planned over the coming year. We're doing the Campus Read over the whole school year. And so some of the ones that we've got coming up pretty soon, on October 10th, Professor Melissa Schaefer O'Connell is going to be doing a talk titled The Legal Foundation of Isms, Classism, Racism, and Sexism in the Immortal Life of Henrietta Locks. On October 17th, we are going to be playing a lecture that is coming from Johns Hopkins. They have an annual lecture in honor of Henrietta Locks that they do every year, and we'll be playing that video of that this year's lecture in her honor. And that is October 17th at 4:30 in 203, just behind that wall there. And we will also be screening a PBS documentary on October 24th titled Unnatural Causes in Sickness and in Wealth. So talking about disparity of and the inequity of healthcare and health across America. And we have some book discussions scheduled every month. If you want to come and just hang out and chat, if you're reading the book in one of your classes, come talk. We're on the, let me get them straight, the first Tuesday at 11 a.m. and the third Monday at 3 p.m. We have book discussions right here in the Learning Commons. And on October 4th, we have two events. So just next week, we have Wear Red Day. We're encouraging people to wear red in honor of Henrietta Locks. That is the day that she passed away in 1951. And then that same day, we're going to be launching our Community DNA Living Art Project. So we're going to be using, as we do a lot of recycled book art here in the library, and so we're inviting everybody, campus community, as well as the greater Sioux community, to come and add your own representation into a strand of DNA that we're going to build out of book pages. So come join. We're launching it on the 4th. It's going to go through the rest of the semester. So come add your own representation in, okay? So let's not hold off anymore. I'd like to welcome Dr. Ron Hutchins, who is the Dean of the School of Health and Behavior. College.
Yeah, somewhere in there. Okay, well, thank you for coming. I know some of you are coerced. That's okay. I'll take audiences however I can get them. How many of you have read or have started reading about Henrietta Locks? Have any of you? Some of you here? Okay. For those of you who haven't, Henrietta Locks was an African-American woman who died of cancer in the early 1950s. And her cells were taken without consent. This was before the days of IRBs. And these cells were amazing. And many of us here, including many of you, are probably alive today because of those cells and what people were able to do with them in research. I am a survivor of polio, primarily because of the research that was done with her cells. Okay, so there's quite a story behind Henrietta. And if you're not a big reader, the book is on Audible. Just how I listened to it going down the road one day.
We have a copy here too.
Okay, so if you want to listen versus, you know, while you're doing all those other wonderful things, you know, running at the sack or whatever, you can catch a little bit about Henrietta. But the story of Henrietta brings up a lot of issues that have been issues in our country since our inception. These are not new issues. And unfortunately, even though we had the civil rights legislation of in 65 and then 68 and IRB that came about in 72, we still deal with these issues on a daily basis today. And so I'm going to talk about, I'd like to pose a couple questions before we really get going here for you to think about as we go through this. Okay, I'll just use my magic finger. Questions considers. Why do many individuals of color not trust the medical community? Well, you don't have to answer that right now. We'll talk about that. But keep that in mind as we go through some of the history. This is a major issue. This impacts, we know, the outcomes. If we look at the CDC outcomes as far as the Healthy People 2020 recommendations for health and healthcare disparities, we see consistent problems in communities of color as far as higher rates of mortality, morbidity, increased rates of diabetes, increased rates of heart disease, increased rates of cancer, and the list goes on. Okay? How does the lack of trust, the next question I want you to think about is how does the lack of trust impact healthcare decisions by both the person receiving the healthcare and the person giving the healthcare? Many of you are going to be going into fields where you may be providing care, and that will make a difference. And what you think today will probably be different tomorrow and the next day and the next day. It's interesting, and we'll talk about some of the research as we get toward the end of the presentation, but it's interesting to see how people's perception and how they deal with bias changes with age. People over 50, you would think, because you know, you're looking at these old users standing up here, you know, those set in his ways. I hate to tell you this though, the research shows I'm less biased than you. Okay? There is a significant difference in perception of bias in people over 50, particularly in healthcare and social services fields. Okay? Experience does help us have a better picture of the world, which is nice to know. And I can tell you from my own personal experience when I was reading this research, I said, yep, I've been there. I've changed my views as I look at this. So a lot of the things I'm going to talk about today as far as what we can do is a journey. It's not something I can snap your finger and says, I'm going to take care of this. I'm never going to have this problem. Yeah, you will. It's a journey. But I'm hoping that I can get you thinking about that path to that journey. What's bias? If we talk about bias, usually I will sit and when I teach a class like that, I'll ask questions and I'll wait for an answer. This would take 3 hours if I'm doing this. You don't have 3 hours, do you? If you do, I'll hang around that long. Is everyone planning on being out of here in an hour? Okay, I'll try to just move it along then. Okay, implicit bias. This is what's most common. Implicit bias, it's an unconscious thing. It's sort of how we're wired. Now, we get wired by learning. Unconscious bias is not a genetic trait. Okay? It's a learned behavior. You see your grandpa act a certain way. You see your grandma act a certain way. And you incorporate that. And you don't really think about it. Now, that worked really good when we were living in the jungle and trying to keep away from lions. You know, bad cat, run. But in a multicultural society, we need to recognize there's too many variables, and this can get us in trouble. It blocks communication. We no longer are in a situation where we need to think, you know, I've got to climb that tree because the orangutan's after me. But that's how implicit bias is. Okay,
we don't consciously think about them. It's things we've watched others say or listened to what other people have said. We've seen things, and they're just sort of there. Okay? Now, they're influenced often by experience. They may be learned by associations. And oftentimes, they're just, we learn it by hanging around the house. Okay? Now, implicit racism can have an idea where you think, oh, you've heard, well, group of people, they're lazy. Or they don't follow directions well. And you don't really think about it. You don't consciously say, oh, they don't. But somewhere, grandma said something. It's planted in here, and it affects how you interact with people. Okay? It doesn't mean that grandma was wrong. It was just the way she saw the world. Okay. Now, on the flip side, and it can be positive too. Implicit biases can have positive. They think, you know, everybody that's a cute little person that's built this tall, that smiles, it's got to be God's gift to everyone. So biases can be positive or negative. Now, when we talk about explicit, that's what you think about it. Those are the guys in Charlotte carrying the signs. Okay? We will not be replaced. Well, God, I hope they are. I guess I just told you my bias. Okay. But the issue is there is a conscious decision that there are others. Okay? And that is usually formed by fear and hate. Okay. Unfortunately, those are things that we have to deal with. And a lot of times it's because we don't even know why we've been fearful. We've just been told we're supposed to be afraid. Politicians do that all the time. That's how they get elected. So, and we need to be aware of that game because politicians have been using that since time immemorial. You know, be afraid of that neighbor over there. Vote for me. Okay. So when we think of explicit racism, those are such things as stereotypes. All Orientals who are 7 foot tall play basketball. No, they don't. Okay. But it is a belief. So bias is always taught. It's not genetic. And one of the things in the United States has never been dealt with. We're one of the few societies that has had a major upheaval in this particular area and hasn't had a way to reconcile. After the Civil War, the best way I've heard it put is the North won the Civil War, the South won the peace. And we see that today. When we see what happened with the destruction of apartheid in South Africa, they dealt with it, honestly. They had truth and reconciliation meetings, and people would sit down with who had been victims and victimizers, and they'd sit down and say, hey, I really screwed up. This is what I did. This is why, you know, this wasn't appropriate. What are we going to do to help you out? They honestly dealt with their issues. Germany did the same thing, particularly Western Germany did the same thing after the Second World War. Eastern Germany didn't, and we see that today in the news. Those are the people in Eastern Germany are the folks that are against the others, the immigrants. You don't see those in the cities on the West Germany side. Okay? That's the difference when a society decides to reconcile. We never reconcile. We continue to fight the Civil War. We continue to have slavery. We just have it in a different name and context now. We call it prison. So, one of the first things we need to do is to acknowledge it. In order to address any of these things, we have to acknowledge them. So let's look at what slavery did in this country and how it impacted the perceptions of the relationship between African Americans and physicians. Now, the first role, if we look at the role of physicians in slavery, Who was the physician working for? What do you think?
The masters.
The master. Yeah, the slaveholder. He was getting paid by the slaveholder. And what was the purpose of the physician's role in keeping it to the slave master? What do you think? He was a mechanic. His job was to keep the farm running, the plantation running. So his interest was not in the slaves. His interest was in pleasing the master, because that's who paid him. Well, like insurance companies today. So oftentimes, one of the things that was very common is if a person had a disease that was causing weakness, and ability to work, they would not tell the master, because the treatment for it, they wouldn't say, oh, you have a chronic disease, or you have a bloodborne illness that's causing you to have weakness, or you have anemia. They weren't at that point. You were lazy and you weren't doing your work. So the treatment for having an illness was to be whipped. Think about that. How many times would you want to go see the doc if they were going to say, oh, you're just lazy? Not a way to build a good patient-doctor relationship. Okay? So you had this bias. Now the other problem when we talk about physicians and slavery, many of the physicians that were slaveholders. And because of the dehumanization of the slave, they would use the slaves basically as objects of experimentation. Okay? Well, let's cut up this slave today. They're not doing a lot of work. They're not, you know, they're past breeding age, and so we can't have any more little baby slaves, and we can't do this, and they're not working, carrying their weight, so I can just use them as a lab rat. And he did. I'll tell you, when I read this stuff, I get ill. For those of us that have practiced in OB, the great American doctor who was considered the father of obstetrics, Dr. Sims. What they don't tell you in the medical classes about Dr. Sims is he's a slaveholder. And he had a number of women slaves. And one of the problems, because these women were being forced to be pregnant at an early age, is they would have fistulas. And so they're whole lower half their body be ripped apart, have holes in it between the vagina and the anal cavity, and we see the same problems in some areas in Africa still today, and particularly with children that are being abducted and some of these wars that are going on over there right now. So what he would do is he would experiment with these women, and he would do these surgeries on them without any anesthesia, because why waste the anesthesia on black folks? Not only because why waste the money? They're just slaves, they're not humans. And secondly, the issue was there was this myth that allowed them to abuse slaves by saying they don't feel pain. Now Sims would actually have other slaves or his doctor friends hold these women down by their four limbs, basically sort of like an Aztec carving party, and would do the surgery on them. After he somewhat perfected the surgery for that time, and I'm sure the Mayo Clinic does a much better job today, but for what they had at that point, then he started after years doing this for white women, although they got anesthesia. Okay? So this was part of this thing, and physicians would do all kinds of things. Some were actually had some scientific basis, others were just nonsense. There was one by a Dr. Hamilton out of Alabama, and his idea was if he could get slaves, obviously were different race, and so they can work in hotter areas, and so we're going to see how hot we can make them, and then we'll give them whatever. He ended up giving them cayenne pepper. It didn't really work, but it he was able to make a few thousand dollars on the deal. And he said, if you give these people cayenne pepper, they can work longer. And what he would do is he would put, he got this slave as part of a bargain, because he had saved some slave owner's life. And so in payment, he says, can I have one of your slaves so I can do these tests on? So he built a pit and filled it full of fire, and then as rocks, and then put the fire out so there, you know, we wouldn't be burning the marshmallows. And then he sat a slave in the pit and put a cover across it so only the guy's head would stick out. And he did this repeatedly, and then when the guy would pass out from the heat, then he'd give him his little pepper concoction. It didn't work, but he was able to make $1 million, or, well, lots of money out of selling it as a packed drug of the time.
Okay. So this was something that
physicians. So again, right from the 1800s, we realized that there's no love lost between the African-American community and white physicians or healthcare workers of the time.
Another thing that happened during this time was around the time of, probably it was about 1780, 1790, there was a group of folks, there was a slave that was,
became a free man, was given his freedom, and lived in somewhere around Baltimore. And he had a skin disease that he would start losing the melanin, he started turning lighter. He was, you know, 1700s singer, evidently. But anyway, you guys aren't Michael Jackson fans, huh? The issue was that it really upset people, including Thomas Jefferson. And Thomas Jefferson and his scientific friends all got together and go, what the hell? You know, if these people can turn white, we can't be, you know, doing this stuff to them. So they had to come up with a theory that said that even though their skin turns white, race is more than skin deep. And so we have to prove that they're a different species. And then when Darwin came out, they even took that another step and tried to give other folks different names. And that occurred during the World's Fair, and they actually brought over a group of pygmies from Africa, claimed that they were a different species, and then put them in the Bronx Zoo. And then afterwards, they stuffed them. Again, scientists were not cool.
So we look at, well, the reason they did this is because in order to justify their religious traditions of the Christian tradition, they could not do what they were doing to another human. But if you could redefine a group of people as being non-human, then it would be okay. And so major efforts occurred during the 1800s to dehumanize people of color. Because if they were not human, and they called that polygenesis.
Monogenesis was the religious concept that everyone came from Adam and Eve. Polygenesis was not everyone came from Adam and Eve. So if they didn't come from Adam and Eve, they're not real people, so we can do whatever we want with them. They're just another farm animal. These are things they don't teach you in elementary school.
So there was this misuse of religion. We look at some of the, there was misuse of science. There was mobilization, this concept that they were others. People were not human, they were others. And this, they continued to reinforce negative stereotyping in order to justify this, in order to maintain slavery. Issues of stereotypes. I love this one. All blacks are hypersexual.
No. But by using that, the slaveholders were able to rape their women slaves because, oh, they just wanted it. That makes this that'd be a cool defense for a rapist today. Oh yeah, that person's just hypersexual, so they, you know, I gave them what they wanted. But that, they were overtly saying that. That's why it was okay for Thomas Jefferson to have, what really was upsetting was having all these little white-looking kids running around his slave quarters. I wonder what that came from.
Good old Tom.
Loved his writings. His behavior was a little out of line. High pain tolerance, this concept of the stereotype of high pain tolerance. You could work someone to death because they couldn't feel the pain anyway. And that was reinforced. You still hear that today. Okay. Lack of intelligence. If they aren't really smart enough, one of the things, particularly in the during the Reconstruction period, is we have to have sharecroppers because the black folks, if you give them, when they have freedom, they aren't smart enough to take care of themselves. It's nonsense. I always find it interesting when I hear people still say that to me. Oh, they're not as smart. I'm going, you know, I worked in prisons for a while, and I used to sit there, and there was this gentleman who was a man of color, came in, talked to me, spoke five different languages. Hell, I have a hard enough time with English. So, but that type of stereotypes continues today. And devious and immoral. What were they devious? They were trying to get away. They didn't like to be beat. I don't think that means they're devious. That means they're a lot smarter than the rest of us. They tried to get away. Okay. And then they were immoral because they had sex with someone other than their wife. Never mind, just called wife down the road to the neighbor. So we have, I mentioned about Dr. Sims, his famous patient was Betsy. He had about four women that he was notorious for. Betsy was, you know, the first. John Brown was the man that Dr. Hamilton roasted. He did escape. He was one of those devious and moral ones that left his owner, headed out to London where he told his story and wrote a book. Phrenology was a real big thing. And for those of you that have talked about, is it Linnaeus? I never can say his name right. The guy that categorized.
The taxonomy guy.
Yeah, the taxonomy guy. Yeah, he used some of that where, well, heads are smaller or heads are bigger, and if they have a smaller head, they're not as smart. It doesn't quite work that way. But, you know, it made good press coverage. He was able to get a book out of the deal. So he wrote that, and that was often used as body types, body sizes were equated to intelligence. Racial hygiene, we've heard that from the guys in Charlotte. This idea of having the pure races. I hope you all realize that racial identification is a man-made thing. It's a social definition. Okay, there is no genetic definition here. And then eugenics. And eugenics was really popular in the United States. Matter of fact, the eugenics movement, it was the idea is you wanted to have only certain people breed because certain people are smarter than other people, and you want to get rid of the bad ones, sort of like trying to breed a good cow. And this was a big movement in the early 1900s in the United States. Matter of fact, Hitler and his Nazi crew said they learned most about eugenics and getting rid of the Jews by watching what the Americans were doing so effectively. Isn't that nice? Some of our most eugenic people, like, I hate to say it because I drive a Ford, was Henry. Okay, he bought a newspaper called the Dearborn Times to promote his eugenics philosophy. And one of my heroes heroines I used to talk about as a heroine, and now after I read about her, I'm having second thoughts, was Margaret Sanger, who started Planned Parenthood. Okay, there's sort of a yin and yang to her, where all of you that may be sexually active and don't want little ones running around and say, thank goodness for Margaret Sanger. But part of her efforts of getting going was in order to keep the underclass from breeding. Now, racial abuse that occurred during the 20th century, not only the eugenics movement, but the ones that are the big hitters here that we hear over and over again, the Tuskegee syphilis study. Tuskegee syphilis study started in 1932. And it was, the idea was they wanted to see how syphilis progress through the human body. Those of you that have studied this disease, we know that it has basically three stages. The primary stage, it comes and goes, looks like a crash, disappears, then it comes back again. There's a chancre, the first step, it's a painless ulcer, comes, goes. Then there's a rash, comes and goes. And then it slowly just starts eating holes through the body. And all of a sudden, there's a hole through the brain. That's what happened to Al Capone. Got a little crazy around the edges. Was missing parts. And so they started this, but they targeted a group of black men that lived around the Tuskegee Institute. And, you know, on the surface in the first part of it, we really didn't have much of a really effective treatment, but there was a treatment. It wasn't all that effective, but it did have some impact. But they chose not to give them any treatment. And then in the 1940s, during the Second World War, penicillin came out, which would have cured the problem. They chose to hide that from them. And they made massive efforts to prevent them from getting treatment, to the very point where they went to their draft board. Remember, this is World War II, everyone's getting drafted, heading overseas. They specifically blocked them from getting drafted because they didn't want them to get pulled in the military because they knew the military would treat them. Their goal is for these people to die so they could do their autopsies. And they pulled this scam through 1972. It's pretty frightening. The result of that was over 100 men died from syphilis. Over 40 of their wives contracted syphilis, and over 19 of their infants were born with severe syphilitic abnormalities. The first group to call it out, by the way, was a group of college students out of the University of Michigan, the SDS. Go guys. They were ignored because they were a radical group. They were ignored for 7 years after they related the story. Until finally, Congress got involved, good old Teddy Kennedy and his crew put an end to it. And there's still a lot of questions about it because there were some real screwy things that happened when they were looking for information to validate what had happened to try to prevent it from happening again. A lot of information disappeared. There's quite a story behind all of that too. But you can see where why this community would distrust the government about health care. They had been scammed with syphilis from 1932 to 78, and they found out about it. If you knew that your grandparents had been scammed like that, and then a disease came out a few years later, it makes a very understandable why the African community in America thought that AIDS was not real or it was a designed disease that was meant to target them. And I was working in AIDS prevention at that time, and I'll tell you, it was a major barrier working with communities of color because of the distrust because of Tuskegee.
Holmesburg Prison was another major one. Holmesburg was a large prison in Philadelphia, and there was a doc there decided he was a dermatologist, decided he was going to make a lot of money by selling research to companies like Johnson & Johnson's, Merck, a number of cosmetic companies. He made millions, but what he would do is he'd do all these experiments on prisoners, primarily prisoners of color, would be the ones that would were the highest percentage of prisoners he used. And, you know, they punch holes in them, you do punch biopsies on a regular basis, rip off their fingernails in order to get tissue, in order to do testing to see what they were doing. The word was that you could always tell a person was at that prison because of the scars they had all over their body when they got out. And that went on for years. Again, prior to IRB.
Eugenics was used not only by, you know, sort of a coercive, voluntary thing, or through going into communities and saying, oh, we can help you out by not having so many kids, and when in their back of their mind they're going,
Let's just not have to breed. But it was also used by courts. And many states had, and still have, legislation that allows people with certain crimes or certain things to be sterilized. And in those places where that is still in effect today, the rate of a person of color being sterilized is 10 times higher than that of a white person who's accused of the same crime. Okay, that's even today. Another thing that happened during the 20th century was radiation studies. A number of people were injected with radioactive material to see what would happen to them. Infants were injected with radioactive material at a high enough level that it killed them without consent. These were orphans that was in that particular group of folks. Another group of black workers who were working at a research facility were injected with high levels of radiation. And also done full body radiation studies were done without without proper consent. They were told that this was any big deal, and yet they were getting more radiation than the folks at Nagasaki and Hiroshima, with obvious results. I think the one that really bugged me when I was reading about this particular issue was a group of black kids in an elementary school who, without their parents' knowledge, were taken into a hospital and irradiated with x-rays with the idea, we'll see if it kills their lice. I mean, they were given severely toxic doses of x-rays. Again, are you seeing the issue here? Can you see why a group of people distrust healthcare? No one told me this when I was going into healthcare. I thought everything was hunky-dory. So in 1972, when a lot of this stuff started coming out, we went through IRB. So if those of you that are in psych and social and filling out those IRB forms, there is a reason that we're having you jump through that hoop. It's not because we really just love to see you squirm. I've got other things other than read those IRB reports, but I see them all. But it's because of the abuses that occurred. We don't want this to happen anymore. And that has helped in some of the explicit bias issues that have occurred in research over the last 30 years. So if we look at what the research says now about what's going on in with particularly implicit bias. We know what explicit bias is. All these things that I've talked about so far have been a result of explicit bias. But implicit bias is that silent thing, the thing we don't think about. The thing where we make that assumption without even realizing we're making that assumption. Holy cats, I'm moving through this and I have a turn page. I could have asked you a question. Maybe I will. Moving on. So if we look at the implicit bias, one of the things we find is there continues to be a perception of a lack of trust between communities of colors and individuals who are providing services. One study done by the American Public Association of Public Health showed that 25% of all people of color that were in those studies stated they felt that there was implicit bias in the visit that they had with their provider. One out of four. That's not a really good track record, guys. And that, you know, that was a study that was done in 2014. So this isn't something from yesteryear. If we look at how this happens, we also see that this same bias is often found not only in communities of color, but in relationships between those that have and have not. We see that poverty also can be a major implicit bias issue when it comes to providing health care. Unfortunately, in this country,
we do see a connection, particularly in urban areas, between poverty and people of color. Although if we look at total numbers of individuals that are in poverty, there's more, this is more white folks that are in poverty than black folks. Okay, but not when we look at percentage of populations. So, but that also has an impact on bias, which I'll talk about. So we continue to see that there's, one of the things that we find with this implicit bias is still, we go back to these slave things that came up, they're not as smart. One of the things we find is when studies, they show that the provider, of, when they're talking to a person of color, a white provider talking to a person of color, spends less time with them. I don't need to talk with them as long. They don't know as much, so they're not going to need to know all this. Now, do you think that that provider actually thought that in their mind? Probably not. But that's why it's called implicit bias. We see the results of this of bias. We don't necessarily think about what's causing it. One of the things that's been shown, particularly in the transplant business, when we look at the percentage of populations that get and give transplants, the highest percentage of the population that gives is a donor is people of color. And yet when we look at the people who receive organs, it's white folks. Now there's a really nifty test that's out there that's been used. I don't know if any of you have been participants with it, called the implicit association test. See Dr. C. Wright shaking his head. He's probably going to give it to me and see if I where I'm at on this now after all this. But it looks at like cup faces. And then you say, you know, oh, are they happy? Are they sad? Are they mad? Are they glad? And they look at, you know, these comparisons. I can't tell you the number of times I have shown a picture of a person who, to me, looks just serious. She's a person of color. And I'll have people say, oh, that person's really mad. I don't know why you got that angry person there. Now, I don't think the people that are telling me that are biased. They don't have an explicit bias gene in their body, from what I can tell. But why are they seeing that person being angry, and I'm seeing that person as okay? And that's what this test does. That's what that, what this is. And that's the tool that's used in a lot of these studies now in healthcare. Okay, it looks at this. Now, that doesn't mean you're a bad person if you've got bias. It just means you need to be aware of it, because if you're not aware of it, you can't deal with it. So we see that it's implicit bias is demonstrated at a higher rate with younger healthcare workers. Where we start, the biggest group is between 30 and 48 of being the most biased in the, on these tests. When people get above 50, there's a significant drop in their implicit bias. Thank God I'm an old guy. Okay. But I can tell you, when I think back about how I process things in my 30s, yeah, I was a lot more biased. And I look back at it now, why in the world did I do that?
I didn't know any better.
No one had, you know, we hadn't, this wasn't the issue we talked about. Treatment, there's been all kinds of test research that's been out there looking at whether treatment decisions are different based on implicit bias. The data's mixed. One study I came across was looking at blood pressure control, and they didn't find that there was any difference in treatment outcomes. Although another study that was much bigger that was done by the American Journal of Public Health, where they looked at 15 studies and did a systematic review, found that there was. That they found that oftentimes treatments might be changed based on implicit bias. An assumption that someone can't take a medication because of their economics, or an assumption they can't get it without looking for other resources, or those type of things would be a case in point. What they found was that, though in all of the studies except for one,
that implicit bias significantly related to changes in patient-provider interactions, treatment decisions, treatment adherence, and patient healthcare outcomes. Now let's think about the history. If you don't trust someone because for the last 200 years you've got the short end of the stick, and they tell you this is the best way to do something, how likely are you to follow their directions?
Very.
Yeah. So again, learned behavior. Do I trust these folks? And that's learned behavior just as much as, well, there's a bias there on the part of the patient. Okay? And again, it was a survival technique. Oftentimes, implicit bias is a survival technique from somewhere in your family's history. So, but we need to be aware of that. If we look at these things, we find that there's always, this bias has an impact across the board. And in most cases, what they found, there was a study that was done by Indian Health Service looking at Native American care and a multiple hospitals across the American Northwest. And what they found was 84% of the providers had an implicit preference for treating white folks. 84%. They found that 23 to 33%, depending on the hospital setting they were in, expressed specific negative stereotypes against Native children. The good thing was, the longer that a person worked in that hospital, once they started working, and the key year seemed to be 10 years, once they've been there for 10 years, that explicit bias started to drop. So we can learn how not to be biased. That's the good news. It was interesting in that American Public Health Journal was that when they did look at bias, there was a specific bias that people liked the medical providers had positive bias attitudes toward whites. What I'd like to think about it as we wrap this up is, okay, what's this all mean? You know, we can beat ourselves up, but that's not the point of this. If we look at, and I'm going to use Henrietta because that's what this is all wrapped around. Henrietta's family, if you've read the story, got all freaked out when they found out that Henrietta's cells were flying all over the world. Now, I had a hard time getting all upset about that because I view the context of those cells. Okay, and I don't view, personally, my bias is I don't view a cell, a human cell, as a human being. But that's my philosophy. That may not be yours. But if we look at this, how do we communicate with people and recognize bias? If you know that the history of the family has been that they've been aware of abuse of medical providers, abuse of the federal government toward their health, trying to gain their communities to not have as many children, and you're their nurse, or you're their social worker, or you're their case manager, what things do you need to keep in mind? If they say, nah, I don't trust you, how do you respond? How would the slaveholder in the
the slave doctor respond? Okay, you're too dumb to know what you're talking about. You just need to do what I tell you. Well, don't some providers still do that today? Do we want to be the slaveholder of the slave doctor? We need to consciously think about what we're doing. We need to consciously think about where would we be at if we were in their shoes. How would we want to think about that? That's how you deal with bias. Okay. But if we don't acknowledge it, we end up being just like the old slaveholder. And that's what people are telling us today in these studies. 25% of people are saying they're feeling like we're treating them like they're the, we're the slaveholder. Not in so many words. But it's our responsibility, not the victims, to make the change. So we need to look at how can we address bias. How do we, so we have Henrietta, her problems there were, there was a lack of communication between the family. Now I'm going to tell you, if you read the book, there's a statement in there about, well, they didn't tell about the cancer. I'm going to tell you in the context of the time, if you were white, you probably wouldn't have been told about the cancer. Okay, back in the 50s, if you had cancer, it was considered like AIDS was in 1985. It was considered an automatic death sentence. And with that, families often would not be told that they had cancer. My grandmother, my great-grandmother, probably had cancer. I went to her bedside. I went to her funeral. I was never told she had cancer. It was not something you talked about. I only found out when I was 50 that most of my relatives in West Virginia died of cancer from being living in the Chemical Valley. But it wasn't talked about in 1950. And yes, I was alive then. Okay? So that is an issue. The idea of, if you read the book, it talks about why, he didn't tell her about the cells because he was afraid to get sued. I don't think so. It makes a good story today, in today's environment. But back then, any cell, anything that was taken from a hospital, that was considered medical waste. And so any medical waste was open game for anyone who wanted to use it. I can remember in the 70s, one of my jobs, first jobs at the hospital, was loading up, taking placentas out of the freezer and loading them up and sending them to different companies so they could do experiments on them. You think the moms were ever told their placentas were going off to Avon to see if lipstick hurt them? No. That was just the way it was. Okay. Those things started changing with the advent of IRBs in the 70s and the concept of a written patient bill of rights that occurred in the 90s. Those are things that are relatively new. So one of the things we need to think about when we read Henrietta Lacks, when they're saying these things, we need to keep it in the context, but we do need to ask ourselves as we read that book, what should we do today? Okay? We wouldn't do the same thing today, hopefully, that what happened to Henrietta in 1951. So to be part of the solution, just to wrap this up, because I know you want to go, some of you, learn the history. Those who do not know history are doomed to repeat it. So by our eugenic friend, Henry Ford. Okay. We need to walk in the other person's shoes. When they're saying, I don't believe you, we need to sit back and say, how come? Instead of, well, you should believe me. We need to ask those questions. That empathy is one of the best ways to build bridges. Remember, that's what they did in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation that we never did after the Civil War. Put yourself in the other person's place. Acknowledge personal bias. That's hard. I've been struggling with that for years. I grew up where bias actually probably kept me alive on the streets of Detroit. But as I left that environment, I've had to reflect on that. Was that really right? could there have been other ways I dealt with the issues I needed to deal with to survive where I was at? Was I right to label a group of people? And now, 40 years later, I'm saying, well, there's probably a better way to skin the cat. One of the things that I think is the most important thing we do is call out bias in our peers. People say these things because they can. So we need to be able to call out bias. We need to be honest with our friends and say, that's not cool. You need to think about this. If this had happened to your family, what would you do? Okay, what would you believe? And then see if we can repair it. One of my favorite quotes is from, and that's how I'm going to end this, is from Robert Kennedy. Said in a speech right before he died, if you are not part of the solution, you are part of the problem. So I challenge you to look at your bias. I challenge you to understand where bias comes from. I challenge you to take a look at the history and how that impacts people even today, 200 years later after some of these things happen. And be part of the solution. And with that, have a great day.